Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Hi and welcome to The Joyner Report at WPRN-FM New Orleans and UFOParanormalRadioNetwork.com. It's good to see you all gathering in the Pal Talk chat room. Hello to all those Omies, and some of them are former Omies, but still Omies to me. And we're going to have a good show tonight. The first thing I want to lead off with is some of you that are on my Facebook friends list, you know that I've been saying, you know, things seem to be kind of heating up around here. I've been hearing bits and pieces for the last 2 weeks, and somebody will walk up and say, so-and-so told me they saw this or that. My ex-neighbor saw something on Monday night, and then my stepson has seen something too. And then, lo and behold, today somebody sends me Roger Marsh's article, and there was 3 sightings that I think, I believe they were on Wednesday night, and within just minutes of each other, they've said 11 or 1101, 1104, something like that. But I did look at the public part of what MUFON puts out there, and apparently there's somebody that was traveling from Dublin to Stephenville on Highway 377 North. And what he or she said is about halfway to Stephenville, I noticed a large white light to my left. So I think that means she would be looking towards the Lingaville area. Lingaville is north and a little west of Dublin, or from Stephenville, a little south. So she said, I looked, or he said, you don't know who is, if it's what the gender is from them. I looked over to see a disc-shaped light lift from the ground and was moving to the north at a high rate of speed and then just blinked out. I never saw it again. It was very fast. I'm not sure if it was on the ground or not, but I think it was about 2 or 3 miles away. It's hard to tell in the dark. And then the other two that are in, you know, just minutes of each other, they're talking about something with lights. One thought at first he was seeing headlights from his neighbor's car, but realized that wasn't what it was. And he said, I saw a white light leave the field and head to everybody heard what I was talking about. The thing that I just wonder about is how we have all these people out in the summertime. To me, it would be a lot more people in the summertime. And we always start getting these reports in the fall and winter months. It just picks up for that time of year. So I don't know what causes that. It's kind of puzzling. But anyway, if you live in the Dublin, Stephenville, Erath County area in Texas, you better start looking up again, because it seems like something's starting up again. And I'm going to keep my ears open, and I'll let you know what I find out. Now, last week we had Thomas and Matthew Reed, brothers that have this ongoing family history of abductions and UFO sightings, just all kinds of things. And I guarantee you, I bet if we did, you know, 5 shows, 2-hour shows, we wouldn't cover it all, simply because it spans over several generations, and it started back in 1954. And those of you that are familiar with abductions know that it does seem to run in families. So tonight we're going to have my goodness, I can't even think. See, every time we have one of those technical glitches like that, it just throws me for a loop. Okay, so tonight we're going to have Tom back with us. Matthew couldn't make it tonight. And we have a return visit from Allison Burgess. She was on with us last week. She's the Assistant State Director of MUFON Tennessee. And then we also have a special guest, Debbie Jordan Cobble. Now, Deb knows something about abductions. She was the central figure in Bud Hopkins' New York Times bestseller, Intruders, The Incredible Visitations at Copley Woods. I think most people just refer to it as The Intruders. She used a pseudonym at that time. And then in 1992, she revealed her true identity, and she co-authored with her sister her own book called Abducted, The Story of the Intruders Continued. Her experiences eventually propelled her into the MUFON UFO network as a field investigator. Her years of personal experience have given her an insight into the phenomena that a lot of us don't have. I am hearing really good things about Deb's future. I understand she's going to be involved in a television show. You know, she's already been on things like Oprah Winfrey's AM Chicago, History Channel's UFO Hunters, the Discovery Channel's Investigation X, and that's the short list. She's been on a lot of things. And so she's also interested in other paranormal activity. So first, Tom, let me welcome you back to the Joyner Report.
Thank you, Angela.
And Allison, I appreciate you coming back on as well.
Thanks, Angela. I really appreciate it.
And Deb, you know, we tried to do an interview one time before, and we've got to get that done someday soon. We had all kinds of technical problems that night. So
I'm jinxing this.
Well, welcome back to the Joyner Report.
Thanks. Thanks for. I feel responsible somehow.
Well, I'm sure you're not. These things just happen. It's a, Joe Montalvo keeps telling me it's the joy of live radio, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Anyway, Allison, do you have anything you'd like to say first?
I just want to say that anything that I say on your show or any other show is 100% my own opinion, and in no way, shape, or form represents the opinion of MUFON International. I just want everybody to know that when I speak, I'm speaking for myself.
All right. Well, we appreciate that. Now, last week we went through a few of Tom and Matt's experiences that were older. They were I think it was an event in 1966, and I know I got a lot of good comments, and people were really interested, and that's why we're having you back, Tom. Now, Tom, you want to talk about some of the more recent things going on with you and your brother?
Sure. I guess we could probably, I think we went to 66 and 67. In 1994 is when things started happening again on a more regular basis, and that was the time my son was born. And we were in Fort Myers Beach, which is, oddly enough, he was born around the same time that Jim Sparks, there was an article about him being abducted there as well. And we started having a lot of anomalies in the home. We had, my son was put to bed face up, and in the morning we found him face down, and we had a rocking chair that my wife at the time had gotten up to check on him, and I felt a need too, and I had gone in the bedroom, and there was a rocking chair moving. So there were some weird things that were happening in a strange, just nothing we had really seen before, but it was enough that, you know, it was we took notice of it, obviously. I guess at that time there was just a little, you know, a sighting here and there, and there was a feeling that we had hoped that what was going on with the family, and we had thought about this before because of my grandmother and my mother and myself, my brother, and the ex-wife Angie. We all started having these, you know, this whole life that mirrored each other, and it was going from, again, generation to generation to generation. So when this started happening with my son, we decided to attend an abduction group, which was run by an individual by the name of Tim Wilson in Fort Myers. And oddly enough, again, Tim Wilson, who we had given the I had given symbols to him that I had gotten or drawn as a child, probably when I was about 10 or 12, about what I had seen on board in 66 and 67, and had given them these symbols, and apparently they were, I was told they were given to Bud Hopkins, which is brings in Debbie again, because Debbie knew Bud, obviously, and she knows Tim as well. So that was just kind of a coincidence that, and now why I mention that is because we were trying to get a copy of my symbols back, and being that she knows him, I think she sent him an email or two. But
well, since you brought that up, there was a question in the chat room last week, and I just couldn't get it in. So would you mind just stopping right there and tell what you remember about the symbols and what you remember about what the ETs looked like? Because I remember that question from last week, and I couldn't get it in.
All right. When I was on the craft, and this is 66 now, 66, I was actually brought further into the craft than I was. When I say further, I meant I had gone down this hallway longer and into this room where they had shown the Willow Tree image, and I had seen there were five beings in there. In that craft, I was kind of in a doorway area where the light stopped, and then it became more of like a metallic black looking when they we could still see, but it was dull. It was lit up a little bit, just, you know, you could make things out, but there was a table, and I say a table because I don't really know what it was, but there was a being standing next to it, and if I was like a clock, if you want to do this as a clock, this would be at like 2 o'clock in front of me, and mm-hmm. then the other one was more like almost 10 o'clock. It was way far to the left of me. And these tables, and I remember what they looked like, you could see underneath them. They didn't have, like, legs hold them up, but they were more like an L. They came up on the outside and bent over, almost like a bracket to hold up a shelf. And there was a bean, if you will, to the left, and a bean in front of me, to again, just off to the right slightly. And the...
What color were they?
I'm sorry?
What color were they?
Well, the tables themselves, the top of it was like a bronze. Mm-hmm. And
the beans, what color were
the beans? No, they were like a pewter color, like a silver blue. Mm-hmm. Almost like a pewter. And but they outside they kind of they illuminate a little bit like a 5-watt bulb would. You know,
they kind of illuminate.
Yeah, outside when we were first introduced, if you will, there was a glow about them, so you couldn't really make out exactly the features, and that's why when we were children and we first saw them, we connected them as a ghost is what we really kind of first, or angels or whatever, but
and they stay the same color outside, they're the same color.
Yeah, they all had that soft white glow about them, and but inside the craft, they were more like a silver blue or a pewter color, and from head to toe, mm-hmm. there was nothing that would be any different. It was just one solid color, except the eyes were darker, and they had long legs and long arms and short bodies and big heads. Pretty much. Pretty similar to what you see typically of a gray today, except that they had, and I refer to them as hoods, but I mean like something that would pull over your head, like a, so they all looked almost identical,
But some were taller and some were shorter?
Some were taller, some were shorter. The one that was in the entrance of the doorway was probably the tallest one, and he's actually the one that had touched my shoulder, and I could actually feel that it wasn't like spongy or weak. I remember it was just like a tap on my shoulder, and then that's just before they put the image on the screen, which was the first one was actually like it looked like that sneaker with that sneaker formation of stars or planets. I don't even know what it was, but I remember it reminded me of a sneaker.
Okay, and, what do you remember about the symbols you saw?
Well, that's where I was going with the table thing.
Okay, go ahead.
The symbols were on the table. That's why I was discussing those. The table to the left and table to the right, it almost looked like it was like one was a primary maybe and one was a backup to something, because they looked almost exactly alike. And the beans were kind of doing basically the same thing, although the left one was not doing as much as the one on the right. And I was closer to the one that was next to me, so I think that those two were more or less communicating. I think that's where the images came from. But they, from the table, from I would say it was about 6 feet long and maybe 2.5 feet wide, looked like Braille to me. It looked like if I can describe the symbols, the whole board was just, if you go to an ATM machine, it looked like that, but in like a bronze in color. And it looked like half C's with dots and something that looked similar to like an F, but maybe with a third line across it. And there were a lot of dots, not so much circles like zeros or anything, dots and lines and these half crescent-shaped symbols, and they were kind of all like run together. It wasn't like they were separated from each other. The whole board looked like that. Which is why I've later in life I went to do the ATM and I go, wow, that's very similar, and I went back and yeah, it is, and I looked at my symbols a little bit, but that's what they look like. And they would slightly he was kind of turned a little bit, so I was looking at his left side, he was kind of looking back, and he would take his hand and just kind of lay it kind of softly. And
so this one alien seemed to be guiding you or handling you? The one was putting his hand on your shoulder?
Well, he just touched it for a second or two, maybe like 2 seconds. But no, he wasn't the one that was like my guide. He was still in the hallway. He kind of like, and I only use the word guide because I have no other liaison or someone that was kind of assigned to me. That's the only way I can really, because everywhere I went, he took me. So he brought me really into this room, and then kind of, and the taller one then just kind of took it from there. And then when I left, I was kind of sent back to this guide. But the one that had his hand on my shoulder, to me, was the one that was kind of in, if there was someone in charge, it was probably him, or at least for what we were doing that moment. I can't speak for everything. But, so yeah, these symbols were matched, identical from one, okay, I shouldn't have said that, not identical, but from what I could see, the boards on each side resembled each other. And that's why I think they were, one was a primary if for some reason, and one was maybe a backup of some sort. And so, yeah, again, he just took his hand and he went, reached farther left and kind of slid it across the board. And he did it a couple of times. And at that point, the screen had changed from a picture of, I guess, and again, a sneaker that resembled some form of star.
So the Braille-like symbols were some kind of a control board.
Yeah, and I think in my thinking on that, if you want to go to what I got from it, was that there was a time where they actually touched their chest. One of them had his right hand on his chest and was able to make some changes in the where we were and that sort of thing. So I have a feeling that it's because of the way they're raised up a little bit, it's easy for them to figure out what they're doing without even having to look. So that's kind of what I thought, or what I've become to think, is why that is. But, you know, so they don't even have to look at what they're doing. They can just feel it and look up. And that's what I got from it. And so these symbols, that there were several that I kind of remembered, but then again, they were all kind of run together. So I don't know where one would start and end, but I was able to jot down, and I kind of went by the, I'll use two at a time. You know, I took one that looked like a half a C, and there was a dot next to it, almost in the middle of it, and another one, instead of a dot, had like a line that came in and out of it, so it almost looked like an E, but it didn't touch, and again, there was one that resembled an F, and so I wrote those down the best that I could, and I had them for a very long time, and I gave them to Tim Wilson in Fort Myers in 1994, and I believe that, well, he told me at that point that he had sent them out to be, you know, to be looked at by somebody, and if they had come back, and there were a few that had never been released, and a couple of them resembled those particular symbols, so I don't know anything more than that, and Debbie has emailed him a couple times to see if he still has them for me.
Well, I hope you can get them back.
Well, I have some still that are very, very close. As a matter of fact, they're on my website, but they're not perfect. You know, they're not as probably quite as accurate, but they're very similar. I mean, it's not like I totally forgot. I still remember them today. So, but
okay.
I had probably close to a dozen of them, and right now I can remember about six that I think I've got really close, and I put them back on. So that's where we are, the symbols. And
all right, and I just want to remind the audience that Tim and Matthew were Tom and Matthew were just young boys, like 6 and 4, and
right.
Tom has more memory than Matt does, but it's an incredible recall to me for just being a child. Now, let's fast forward.
Day.
Huh?
I said I'd written them down the following day when I'd taken my horse up there just the next day and ran up and looked for the spot and found it and had written them down, you know, immediately. So I had them for a long time. Even when I gave them to Tim, I think the paper was still had turned almost a yellowish tint to it. So I had them a long time.
Okay. So you went back with your horse the next day.
right after school.
And decided to draw what you'd seen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's fast forward a little bit. Now, Matthew has had some very recent activity, and I know that we need to give credit to your MUFON investigator that's worked on this this whole year. You want to do that right quick?
Oh, sure. This year, and actually I think it was almost the end of last year, Steve White, in my opinion, absolutely did a fantastic job. And why I say that is because this has been talked with since my first investigator was Robert Blechman back in 1987, and it's gone through several different hands, and because it was so complex and everything, it, I was lucky enough to my investigator was a police officer for 30 years and a crime scene investigator, so I was definitely assigned the right person for it, and he took, it's been almost a year that he's been working on this, and he's just done a great job in what he's been able to pull up and unveil, and I'm really,
he conducted a very thorough investigation, and we're very lucky to have him as a field investigator here in Tennessee. He was absolutely the right person for the job in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he got an award for it, too, of some sort, didn't he, Allison?
Yeah, at our state conference, he was named Field Investigator of the Year, and he absolutely earned it. He's a really great guy. I consider him a friend, and I think that, like I said, we're just very, very fortunate to have him as part of our team.
And,
all right. Go ahead.
Thing about this willow tree image that has been this had this hold on us, if you will. Oddly enough, and I don't know if I mentioned it last time or not, but we went to his house for dinner at the end of the investigation, well, about several weeks ago, and he had sent me a picture of this willow tree image with the lake and everything, and it's something you really might want to take a look at. The drawing that I sketched out as a child almost matched his front yard, willow tree and lake and everything, almost as if someone had just sat there and sketched it from his yard, except that the willow tree was on one side of the lake and mine was on the far side of the lake. But it is definitely, again, there's a lot of there's like a web to things. It's kind of tie, everything kind of ties in with each other. I found that very interesting as well.
Well, let's go ahead and give them your website so they can take a look at that. The listeners can see what you're talking about.
All right, it's tomreed.info. Tomreed.info. And there's probably more in my a lot more on my Facebook, which I think you have also, but
right.
Tomreed.info is going to be the one that I'm going to be working on more so than Facebook. So.
Okay, just one more quick question, because this came up in the chat room also last time.
Fire away.
And then I want to move away from this and get to some of the more recent stuff. But Lily wants to know, at that time, did you see, you know, you went back with your horse and all that. Did you see any damage to the ground or trees in the area?
I didn't really at that point look for that. So I'm going to have to say no. I did find where it was. I mean, I found the area that I had broken through. I mean, I had, when I went with my horse, I had, like, I ducked on the mane of my pony, and the brush kept hitting the back of my neck and everything when I rode under it, and then I came in and there it was, and I knew exactly that was a spot that it had been in. The same, the line of the tree there, I mean, I knew it. But as far as seeing ground marks or anything, no, I'm afraid I didn't actually, I think I was just really surprised that I even found it, because that was the first time really that something like that had happened. And it was just like a chill ran through you. You know, your hair stands up on end. You're like, oh my God, this is it. You know, this is where it happened.
Yeah, and you're a little kid, and you just thought you saw a ghost. So,
yeah,
all right.
You know, I had a nightmare. You know, like, oh my God, and then you're there, and you're like, oh my God, it's, you know, and then it was just it was wild to pull your, you know, to get yourself to break through that tree line, and then you're like, my God. So, and actually the picture that's on your website, I'm standing on a rock that was actually at that location. I mean, that was a big boulder, and that's what I noticed when I was taken there. I saw that boulder, so I knew where to start looking, and that's why I'm standing on it when I had my picture taken.
Okay. Now, Deb, I'd like to bring you in now. Are you still with us? I hope.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm still here.
All right. Does any of this sound familiar to you at all, or what?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Some of the details that he remembers are very similar to some of the details I remembered, which, you know, all that's already been recorded down, you know, 20 years ago. So,
right.
But I,
tell us how you got involved here.
Well, first of all, I'm like Allison. I am a MUFON investigator, but I was not assigned to Matt's case, and anything that I say is all because I'm an experiencer. That's why my state section director had mentioned to me about Matt. They had already been working with him for some time, and they kind of felt that maybe I might be able to, he was wrestling with some things, and I might be able to, you know, be of some assistance for him, like a buddy, you know, kind of
just support,
a little, yeah, support, moral support.
And he's in Indiana near you, right?
Yeah, he's in Indiana, and he's not too far from me. And so I'm like, yeah, sure, I'd be glad to come and meet him, because that's why I, you know, came forward with my identity. That's why my family let Bud write the book to begin with, and all this. It's all about trying to help people, because there's a lot of people out there who have had these weird experiences, and I've been fortunate that I had a lot of support from my family, friends, neighbors, coworkers, because they were all present when things were happening, you know. So I'm like, yeah, I'd like to meet him. Stuart Hill is my state section director, and he also felt he knew some details that I didn't know, you know, about Matt and his case, and he thought that he recognized some similarities, so he thought it might be interesting from that perspective as well to see the two of us meet. When I met Matt, it's hard to describe to somebody that hasn't had this kind of an experience, but when you meet someone that, you know, shares this kind of experience with you, you kind of, it's like a knowing. And that's the only way I really know how to put it. But you just, when you look into their eyes, then you just know that they have seen some things that you've seen. And I don't know how I know that. I can't explain it. I know how crazy it sounds, but it is what it is.
Okay.
And when I met,
sounds good to me.
You know, and when I met Matt, I saw in him things that I knew in myself, you know. And I saw that he was, you know, having a hard time with it. We talked for, Matt, I and Stuart talked for about an hour, and then went out to look at his vehicle because he had some things.
Tell us about his experience, Matt's experience, so that we have the back.
Well, I don't want to say too much about that because I'm not the researcher on the case. Plus, I don't know the details that well, and I would be afraid I would say the wrong thing. Tom probably could tell you better about Matt's experience than I could. I was focused
more on...
Yeah,
Matt's case is ongoing, so we normally don't comment on ongoing cases.
Right. But I can say that some of the things that we talked about were familiar to me, and even similarities that we had outside of this subject, personal tastes and hobbies, interests, things that interest us. There was just so many similarities. It was almost like I, you know, met a long lost brother. We share a passion for photography and just all kinds of things. The similarities were interesting, and but you know, and like I said, I really don't, I can't really tell you too much about what happened to him. But then through Matt, I got a chance to talk to Tom, and then I just found the similarities with Tom and I were even more so. So, I don't know. It's just, it's weird how this little, it's like somehow, well, the people that I've met hundreds of people that claim to have these experiences over the last 27 years, and I can bet I can count on two hands the people that I feel this kinship with, and it turns out there's this, like Tom says, like this web of connections and synchronicities that go all over the place. Like, what are the odds that I would be dear friends with Tim Wilson, who, you know, worked with Tom from the very beginning in Florida? And,
right.
I mean, you know, just strange things like that. The symbols that Tom mentions about are very similar to things that I drew myself in the late 80s from memories that I had of being in that place. Even when he says, talks about the black wall thing, that's something that I shared also. Some of these symbols I saw were like on a black wall, but they were kind of like in negative, you know, like white compared to the wall, you know, just stuff like that.
Okay.
Can I ask
but,
a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, would it be all right if I mentioned the DVD, Deb?
Yes, go ahead. I guess. Deb, is that all right?
You mean the CD that I sent you?
Yeah, do you mind if we talk about that for a minute?
Well, if I can, I would, you know, I would be glad to. When I went to see, I'm sorry.
I just want to explain to everybody the hesitation here, I think, is Matt's case, or this part of the case, has been separated from Tom's part of the case. And this vehicle thing going on is still being investigated. So just so everybody understands, MUFON people are not real. You have to be limited in what they can say about something that's an ongoing investigation. So if you feel, Deb, that the CD is something that would violate that, well, let's just forget it. I mean, because I noticed you hesitated and said, if I can.
Well, I don't want to cause any problems for anybody, you know. Like I said, I wasn't the I'm not the investigator on Matt's case, and I wasn't brought to meet him as an investigator. I was brought to meet him as an experiencer and for support, you know what I mean?
Now that being said, I guess Tom can talk about whatever he wants to. So, Tom, would you like to tell us about it, or?
I'll touch on it. I'll be careful here, but out of respect, the disc that I have in my hands was not anyone else's property. It was in a third party who just happened to be there and capture some things on a videotape. So it didn't come from anything that was a result of the investigation itself, really.
Okay.
It was a third party who filmed it. And this is now a year after the investigation started on the SUV, where my brother was abducted from this burgundy SUV.
And what year are we talking about?
This was in April of 2009.
Okay, go ahead.
And so we're going now about a year later, and the SUV still had some anomalies. It was still putting off, and there's more to it than the magnetic field, but that's all I'm going to talk about because that's what's on the disc. And again, it was just a random lucky shot that somebody had with a camera for the most part. But the individual was walking up and down the side of the SUV, about probably maybe a foot away or so, and when the compass was brought next to the SUV, the compass would turn counterclockwise. And for the whole walk of the SUV, it would just turn. And then when the individual turned to go back, it would turn clockwise. So the still, even after a year, the size of the vehicle was still putting off enough of a magnetic field to spin a compass. And I have that disc in my house. So it's the only reason I feel comfortable talking about it, too, because it's actually my disc. But just to give you an idea that there's physical evidence on that case, and that's another reason that I don't want to say any more about that for obvious reasons. But it's interesting, and Debbie was there to witness it. So,
so Debbie, you saw the compass spin?
Yes.
Yeah. So something's going on with that vehicle, and it's still going on a year later, or more than a year later, right?
Almost 2 years, yeah.
So nobody's been able to figure that out so far?
Well, there was a lot of documentation, but that's, you know, earlier on. But so that person's no longer working the case. Other people are now. They've a more advanced group with better equipment and so on. So it's in good hands right now.
Okay, well, I think that, you know, we can say that MUFON STAR team has started work on this case with the vehicle and Matt's experiences. Now, I'm just trying to think here. Matt has had the most recent abduction experiences. Is that right?
No, I did. February 2nd.
Okay, February 2nd. I couldn't remember if that was you or Matt. So, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was, and again, this is what I meant about patterns and this form of a web. And there's a lot to that, too. After all this time, you kind of start figuring things out. And if you look at the timing of some of these things, it was in, you know, 66, 67, 69, children kind of indoctrinated, brought along, and then there were a couple little things in the 70s, but they were more like sightings and orbs, but nothing really worth talking about when you bring yourself to this level.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course 94, when my son was born, there was a lot of things going on at that point, and again the Tim Wilson connection, and Jim Sparks was abducted right down the street from my house. The same time my son was born, and then it was quiet, and it was quiet for a while, and then all of a sudden, 2009, 2010, you know, it starts again. And you're right, my brother was first with the April thing, which oddly enough, here we had he had made a call or two to have somebody come out, and so. It took a little while to get some reaction there, to get some, I guess they're, you know, they're busy or what have you, but it took a little time to have them come out. So that's when I made a call to, a little bit after that, to Tennessee. So I had placed a call to Tennessee to help assist with Matthew, since I lived here, and maybe just try to get the ball rolling again for him. And right around that time, they actually started working on his case. And so February, around that time, I had my girlfriend living here, and I was kind of, we were talking about a little bit of these things that have been happening, only because I was on the phone with my brother a lot at that point. And you would hear, there would be things in the house that would, she would think I was home when I wasn't home, it is kind of strange how this whole thing starts. You can kind of tell ahead of time that something's going to happen. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but there's a vibe, you know, and I keep saying it's like having the three full moons at once. I mean, you've got that, you can't sleep, there's something going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, anyway, I went to bed, I don't know, 11 o'clock, and, around, not around, I don't know exactly, 2:35 in the morning, I woke up out of a dead sleep and not alone, but I couldn't move. I felt, okay, this is the best way to describe it. I felt like a mannequin is just how it was. You were like, you couldn't move your chest, you couldn't, you can't take a breath, nothing will move, you can't wiggle your toes. You're just in this state, and it's like a mannequin, but you're alive inside of it. I mean, that's how it feels. I mean, you can't move anything. And
that's probably what some people would call sleep paralysis, right, Deb?
Yeah, there's a lot of researchers out there and debunkers too that would blame every abduction on sleep paralysis. That might be an explanation for a lot of them, but it doesn't cover all of them.
Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Okay, thanks. So, anyway, I have a black dresser at the bottom of my bed, and I've got a clock on it with blue digital numbers. And when I had woken up, and I'm awake now, the room was somewhat, and again, this always happens, you can always see when this happens. You can see fairly well. So there's the light kind of, I'm not going to say, you know, wham, the light, you know, it's beautifully lit up, and it's not like that. It's a lit up enough that you can see a lot more than you should be able to. And and my feet were up near the ceiling fan, and my neck was on the bed and part of my neck, and I was actually being returned at that time. And one of the things that's interesting about that, on this particular time, it wasn't like I came back like I was supposed to. When I was being laid back down, if that makes any sense, and I came, my head hit first, my neck, and I'm looking at the clock, and it was 2:35 a.m., February 2nd of this year, and I couldn't breathe at all. It was almost like I was choking. I couldn't move my tongue. I couldn't move anything. I mean, nothing. And so slowly, I was able to kind of, I just hit the bed, I was able to grab the, and it wasn't far because I wasn't being laid down perfectly level with the bed. The headboard was closer to my left side, and I kind of forced my left arm out there, and I kind of got my fingers around the, I got a steel headboard, and like a steel canopy bed, and was able to grab onto it a little bit, but not actually put my hand around it.
So maybe you could move somewhat then if you were able to put your hand on the bed.
Well, like I said, this was just before I hit the bed.
Okay.
This was like 20 seconds of not being able to breathe. I mean, it seems forever.
Mm-hmm.
And just as I hit the bed, I was able to move my left arm over a little bit. And then I hit it, and I was awake the whole time. I got out of bed, jumped in my, went right into the bathroom, sat on the toilet. I put my head in the sink. I ran water on my face just to catch my breath because I literally thought I was dying. It was that kind of a feeling. I mean, and then, of course, the room wasn't as lit up as it was. I flipped the light on and just put like a cold cloth on the back of my head and sat there, and I was up pretty much for the rest of the night. I wouldn't, it was crazy. I mean, it was, and usually when something like that happens, you don't really remember being taken. At least I don't. It's kind of like and whatever it is or how you're moved, and I use the word moved because I'm not going to, transported and all this nonsense. When something happens, you're moved. I don't know really how that happens because it's not like there's a real process that takes time, okay? And most of the time it happens, and I think probably if you look at it, almost 100% of the time it happens, you're either sitting in a car or you're laying in bed. You're stationary. And you never see someone being abducted jogging. You know, it's you're not moving. So I think there's a lot to being still when this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're returned, you don't always come through whatever it is evenly. You know, sometimes you're able
sometimes
to...
Sometimes you get a herky-jerky ride, I guess.
Well, I don't think that way. But, yeah, there's been some... There was one that was a little rougher than the other, and this was it. this wasn't the ride itself. This is how you come out of it. When you're sometimes you can breathe and you come out of it all at once. Sometimes it's so quick you wake up the next morning because you never really wake up. You just the next morning you wake up and you think you've had one hell of a dream. Other times you're awake before you're able to to breathe.
In this particular abduction, do you remember where you had been, what had been happening, or is this your only memory?
No, there's one little piece of it that I remember, but that's it. It's like a 5-second clip, and that's it. But the reason I want to make this really clear is because this is important. When you come back on a bad trip back, okay, you can literally be wide awake. You can hear, you can see, can't breathe, can't move until the last couple of seconds before you're released, and then you're okay. But there are times when it's been like 3 seconds, but this time I was watching that clock and it hadn't turned yet, and I'm saying it's about 20 seconds, but when you can't take a breath, it seems like forever. You know, you really start to panic, yet you can't.
Yeah, I get that.
Right, and that's, I don't know if you've ever heard that before or what, but it's happened more than once. So, anyway, I was up the entire time.
What was the 5-second clip that you remember during the abduction? Just a little 5-second blur. What did you get?
I was laying down, and it looked like kind of like an oxygen tent in a hospital, where you have that white. It almost looks like a liner for a shower curtain type of thing,
mm-hmm.
white. Okay, and there were like shadows of individuals, and I was I just remember yelling, "Get away from me! Get away from me!" And really loud, you know, "Get away from me!" You know, and just kind of screaming at them. And that was it. And then I remember the 2:30, looking at the clock at 2:35 in the morning. And that's really,
well,
that's all I remember.
Dan, this question's for you, okay?
Sure.
I hear about this stuff quite often, you know, where somebody goes to bed, they talk about their abduction experience. But how do people tell the difference between a dream and the real thing? How do you tell the difference?
Well, I can only speak for myself, but when I have a regular dream, and I don't even really remember my dreams very much, you know, but when I do wake up and I remember a dream, and usually by the time I've been up for an hour, I don't remember it anymore. But when I have this weird stuff happen, the longer I'm up, the more I seem to remember. It little comes back to me. So by the end of the day, I remember a lot. You know what I mean?
Right.
And these dreams that I have, the vivid ones that you know, I call most of what I remember still dreams because that's the way I got to live with it. But these quote-unquote dreams that I had, or memories, if you want to call them that, they are vivid, and they're in 3D, you know, and they're in color.
Okay.
And
so, okay, well, that makes it pretty plain to me. Now, because the ones, you know, that where, you know, you had a car experience, too, and so did Tom and his grandmother, mother, and brother. Now, I understand, mm-hmm. to me, you know, I can understand those because you wake up and you're in a different part of the car, you're outside of the car, or, you know, and you notice that time has passed without you realizing it, or missing time, 2 or 3 hours. Well, that, to me, and that's why I asked the question, was because I can see that. I couldn't figure out how. I have people, friends that are experiencers, and they always talk about it. It was like a dream, and then I'm like, well, how do you know it wasn't a dream then?
Well, that's the gate.
you know, I was awake the whole time. I was awake from 2:35 till the time I never really went back to bed that night. I mean, I didn't go back in my bed and then wake up later. I mean, I was laid in my, and I was wearing white jogging pants with gray stripes down the side of them, and that's when I first realized, because I never wore those to bed. So it was the first time I had actually really worn those. I just passed out then. I was exhausted that night and just crashed right there. And so I never had gone back to sleep. I mean, when I woke up, I was gasping for air. I mean, as soon as I got my air back, I went right in the bathroom and took care of myself. I mean, it was not even close to a dream. I mean, I was awake the whole time, and I was experiencing physical effects. I mean, I was just practically broken out in a sweat.
Tom, are you saying that you went to bed without pants on, and when you woke up, you had pants on? Is that what you're saying?
No, not at all.
Okay,
maybe they make that clear. No, I was actually just wearing these white sweatpants and a little tank top, and that night I was working late and decided to, I just took a shower, threw on the sweatpants, watched a little bit of TV, went to bed at 11 o'clock. That particular night I was kind of like sleeping on top of the blankets, because I had my pants on and stuff with a little bit of a throw over on me.
Okay.
So I remember those pants. I remember the stripes. I was looking up my ceiling fan. I could see the stripes on my pants going right up to the ceiling fan. When I could finally get my breath again, I just got out of bed and went right into the bathroom and threw water on my face.
Okay, yeah.
So that wasn't just a some type like a memory type of thing. That was a physically affected me.
Okay. Let's see. I know that. I feel like we're ignoring Allison. Allison, is there anything you would like to add?
I'm sorry, what was that? I couldn't hear you.
I said, I don't want you to feel like you're being ignored, but is there anything that you would like to add at this time?
Well, there's not really anything I'd like to add outside of, the fact that this is what I consider to be a pretty credible case, and Steve White, the field investigator that actually worked this case, did it out as an unknown. It is a Category 3 close encounter of the fourth kind. So, to me,
okay. Well, why don't you explain to us the protocol about that, just so people will know what a Category 3 is and what does that mean?
Well, we use the Valley classification system to categorize all of our UFO sightings, and a close encounter of the fourth kind. Is something that involves, not only just an object with maybe perhaps an entity, but then you've got, an actual abduction going on. So that's sort of how we sort of categorize that.
So it's a strong case, then.
In my opinion, it is, absolutely. And I really feel like everybody that was interviewed by the field investigator is credible. I feel like the documentation as far as the polygraph and the statements from the hypnotherapist, the blood work and everything, all seems in line with the story, and I believe him personally. I think that makes it a really compelling case.
Okay. Now, let's go to this other topic, just to remind maybe the listeners that were here before. Explain the blood type of your family, Tom, and how you think that might be related to this.
All right, well, I'm O negative, Rh negative, which and from what I'm hearing now is the blood type that, for whatever reason, seems to have the most interaction, if you will.
I think they call you a universal donor, right? Because
right, my blood can be given to anybody,
right?
But I receive it only from an O negative donor. But The other thing about it is that there's only a 0.7% of the people in the world have it, and 80% of those are in Egypt, and the rest of it, a good chunk of it's in Red China, but very few in the States. And then my son is AB negative, and I'm sorry, my son is A negative, and his mother is AB negative, and they're extremely rare too, but they can still receive and give blood to others, but it's just a rare bloodline. So within my family, aside from my father, our stepfather, we were, from what we have traced back, and we're going to recheck some of that as well more recently, Rh negative, basically. O negative, A negative, whatever, but we're all Rh negative for the most part. Again, except my father and my grandmother, I don't know. But so I feel that there's a real connection to our blood and our DNA. And what one of the other things I read about just recently was that Time Life did a little story on Rh negative blood, and in general, it seems to be Rh negative factor is one of the few things and that has been connected with some form of ESP. That and I just found that to be a little odd too. But
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Time Life has an article on it. So I know that when go ahead. I'm sorry.
I know that Tom feels this is one reason, or one of the reasons, I guess I should say, that his family has been chosen or taken. Do you have any feelings like that? What's your blood type?
I'm A positive, and my mother is A negative. I don't know, but I can say, for about a period of a year after the June 30, 83 incident, I had all these weird things happen to me. One of those things was that I had a lot of information coming into my mind, into my brain, which I would write down. And one of the things that I wrote down multiple times and made known to Bud and the other researchers that Bud worked with was that I felt as if somebody told me that there were answers to their questions about us in our blood.
Right.
And I tried to get, for years, to get somebody to look at stuff like that, but nobody paid any attention to me. So that's why when he started talking about blood, when we first started talking to each other, that kind of got my interest, because I had always had this sort of thing going on, you know, that somehow there are answers in our blood if people would just stop and look. I don't know if that's true. That's just something that I had in my head that I wrote down a lot and tried to tell people. You know, I realized how crazy it sounds. So,
really, because that's kind of what happened to me. And in my summary, which is on UFO Casebook, I said the same thing, that when I was very young, that there was something about our DNA, and this is when I was 6 years old. I said this, that there was something about our DNA, and that we were important, and that there was a reason that they needed us, and that was the feeling. And I don't, again, it wasn't like an ESP thing where I was just being flooded with stuff. I mean, it was just kind of a way of the way that it was, and I still to this day don't really know exactly how to explain it, but it's like a touch, a feeling, and visuals, and you kind of get this, you finally understand kind of what they're trying to tell you, which is another thing about DNA, since we're on the subject, that every one of my family has an IQ of 140. So, and I think, Debbie, what's yours, 149 or something?
I've been in Mensa since 1993, and you always talk to me about why you're working in a factory.
Right.
To pay the bills. But, most of the members of my family are, I would say, above average of intelligence. Yeah, my test was like 147.
So I think there's something to that too. So I do believe that DNA plays a part in it. And again, it's only because of the feelings that I've gotten and within the interaction and the fact that my we take my son. I don't want to get too much into this. We talked about it before, but he's off the charts. So I would think that if there was some form of, I think there's a blending. I think that there's blood being not taken from us, but I also think that there's something being incorporated in our bodies that is being passed on to our children. And that's why I think children are being abducted at young ages, and they're following that path with those children. I think it has to do with whether they are experimenting or what have you, but there is no reason for what's been happening to my son to...
So you... Let me see if I understand you. You feel like the ETs are enhancing your own DNA either by mixing it with theirs or adding something, some kind of additive to enhance. Is that right?
I don't have any other way to go with it. My father, my stepfather, he was the only one who didn't really have this happen to him. And he's the only one that didn't have Rh negative blood. Although he wasn't a child either, and what happened to my mother was at a young age. But if you look at patterns and or the common threads and the feelings you got when you were on board and what they were relaying to you, that we're important, they need us, and your offspring are becoming more and more intelligent and have forms of remote viewing, which is documented. It's coming from somewhere. I mean, it's the only explanation, and I'm not saying I'm right. It's what I feel about it. And
I don't really know what to think. I see patterns. I've seen it for 25 years in some people, in some families. I don't know what it means. I mean, and nobody's really told me anything. And it's not that I feel like I'm better than anybody else or special. That, you know, I'm just saying there's something going on. I don't know what it is. I think it may be important. Somebody should look at this, you know.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting because Joe Montaldo, who is the owner and producer of this station, he has been doing a lot of research in this regard for quite some time. I know he just ran a poll on Facebook even just to get people to give their blood type and if they've ever been abducted and their eye color too. He's interested in eye color. So
I'm Hazel.
I have one blue eye and one hazel eye and one blue hazel and one green hazel.
Okay.
Four.
Yeah, I got two in the back of my head. My kids will tell you that.
Yeah.
So your son is off the charts. He has these remote viewing abilities. I read a report that said he could accurately, and it was a document, a letter from a PhD, that he could accurately tell what the numbers were the doctor was writing down. You know, and he wasn't able to see what he was writing, he does have some unusual abilities, whereas, you know, we've all heard about the remote viewers, but usually they're trained to do that. Your son's had no training, right?
Oh, no, in second grade, he did a test and tested it in 99th percentile for the entire country for mathematics, and we thought it was just related to, you know, he's good in math, and then in fourth grade he joined a chess club and beat everybody and got to play the principal, and they said if he could beat the principal they would bring in a chess pro, and he beat the principal and they brought this chess pro in, and she was unbeaten. She's from West Palm Beach, and he beat her. I think, you know, who knows if she gave it her best try, but he did beat her and she was unbeaten. And then he, you know, of course, he got nominated for People to People, and he was given a test of mathematical equations for, again, this was just like something for gifted children to see if just where they placed and how, you know, with other children that are gifted. and he beat their best time, and I want to say by like 20 seconds, it was like 50 some odd questions, and you had so much time to do it, and you were rated on how your accuracy and how quick you could get it done, and he excelled in that, and then he started doing these mathematical equations where he was way too young to be able to do these. And I've got letters and reports from school, and I can't post those because he's a minor. A lot of people say to me, well, why doesn't your son go on the air, be interviewed, or what have you? He's just a kid still.
Yeah, he's just a kid, and you're not going to, get a kid out in the public.
Right. But, yeah, it kind of started with that. And then, of course, there was this incident where, and it's in the MUFON report, so that's public record now, but where he saw an incident happen before it happened within 2 or 3 days. So it is weird. And to be honest with you...
back up a little bit. He's able to make predictions?
Yeah, it's actually...
Said he saw an incident 2 or 3 days before it happened.
Right. And
Tell us about that.
And it's in, a matter of fact, I sent you that, I think. I attached a piece of that to an email to you today. But he came running in my room when he was probably in, I guess, maybe 6th grade, and ran in and woke me up and had, thought he saw somebody looking in my bedroom window and that they had come around. I used to have a little 17-foot boat, and it was near my... parked in the out the garage off near my master bedroom, and he thought that someone had stolen the boat and was looking in the window is what he thought in the beginning. And then I was just talking to him because they're in a white Toyota with no rims on it and painted a picture of the car to a T, and there were 4 thugs and so on. And I'm like, it's okay. I thought he was having a nightmare. And I said, well, don't, I'll walk you to, whatever, walk to his room. And ran back in my room, and he actually crashed with me that night. And about 2 or 3 days later, I got an offer on my boat, and I sold it, and trailer and everything. So that part of it kind of, came true in some respects. But then we were sitting on the front porch, and sure enough, he stands up, and he was sitting to the right of me. He stands up on, it was a narrow porch, really, and came up and kind of walked in front of me and kind of backed up near between me and the front door of the house, and just with a, like, this stare on his face, just looked at the car, and I looked at him, and I looked back at the car, and I thought to myself, no, it's, and sure enough, there's a white Toyota, no rims on it, 4 thugs in it going to our neighborhood, and we were surrounded by million-dollar homes. I mean, we were not in a neighborhood like that. There's gated communities and everything. So there was the car, and the boat's gone. So what he saw, who knows what their intentions were, but he had said the boat was gone, and this car would, these 4 individuals would be in a, like an old white, it was a white, old, like a Toyota Corolla, and it had no rims on any of the tires. And kind of described the people too, so that happened. And then my mother and father, we can change the subject. But
how old was he at that time?
He was about 6 or 7.
Okay.
All right, and so then after that, my parents, they lived in Litchfield County in Connecticut. And he had this feeling that something was wrong, they were in danger again. And it only happens when he feels danger again. This has only really happened twice, and this is the other incident.
Mm-hmm.
And thought that there were people going to hurt, his grandmother and my father, Howard, at the time. And we had a huge red barn where we kept classic cars. We had a 71 Ford Torino in there and an old Chevelle, and kind of just a hobby. And but it was open. You could get into it. And then we had another house on the property, too, but it used to be an old post office. And it was just a historical house, you know, and it was just unique in itself. And we had this apple orchard and stuff. So anyway, we called the house because he was so adamant about it, and I said, okay. So it was later at night. It was about 11:30 or 12, and it was too late to be calling, but he insisted, so I called. And I spoke to my father, and I said, is everything okay? You know, Chris has got, and they kind of knew what he could do, so didn't really question the call. And they said, no, we're fine, and flipped on the light, looked outside just to make sure, and went back to bed, and just to let him know everything's okay. So mm-hmm. The next morning, I get a call about 8 o'clock in the morning, and not far across on an intersection that they lived on. And there was a, like a pilot, or if you will, or a little gas station with, you know, your typical little grocery store type of thing. And he was robbed that night. And, they traced the footprints in the mud and everything that they saw. These individuals were hiding in the red barn where the classic cars were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of, it was really bizarre because he was so adamant about that. It wasn't, I think, or even he'd wake me up and made me call them.
Right.
And it was just remarkable. And this is what he can do. Now, if this is normal and an everyday thing, then fine. If it's not, then it needs to be, you know, recognized that there is definitely something here. I can't do that. Nobody else in my family can do that. Where did it come from?
I can't do it either. Deb.
No one asked
me, Deb, you've got, just a second, Tom, just a minute. Deb, I think I remember you have three kids and seven grandkids. Is that right?
Well, I've got two children of my own and two stepchildren and seven grandsons and a granddaughter.
Okay. Have you ever noticed anything about your own children or your grandchildren that would be similar to this?
Well, I'm a little prejudiced on my kids, but my oldest son, you know, every one of my kids is different people. But my oldest boy in particular, developed a database for his high school sports department, athletic department, when he was in the 10th grade. And he's 30 now, so that's been a while back, and computers were a lot older and dinosaurier than they are now. And they recognized that he had this potential, so they put him in some college courses for computer stuff when he was still in high school. So that by the time he graduated from high school, he also graduated with a degree in computer stuff and went to Purdue for a while. He didn't graduate from Purdue, but he did meet his wife there. And he's a Microsoft engineer now, and he's one of, there's only 14,000 people in the country that holds this Microsoft certification he has. So he's a total computer geek and D&D player, WoW player, World of Warcraft, you know. And
have you ever observed any psychic abilities or him being able to remote view or any predictions like that?
You know, not that I'm aware of, but Robbie's always been all just, you know, real bright kid. And when he was about the same age as my granddaughter now, when he was about four, I remember my mom and I were driving past the hospital, local hospital in town, and my son says, he points to the hospital, and he goes, that's where I worked, Grandma. And my mom's like, oh, yeah? And he said, yeah, I used to work there. He's four, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my mom said, well, what did you do? And he said, I was a doctor. And she said, well, what kind of doctor were you? He said, I took care of little kids. I was a little kid doctor. And she said, well, what was your name? He said, Dr. Now, and this is where I get a little fuzzy. He said, Dr. Bill Stein. And we didn't know whether he.
Did you ever check to see if there was a Bill Stein that worked there in case it was a past life memory?
Funny thing, well, my sisters both worked at that hospital at the time, and they, when my mother told them about it, they kind of looked around to see if they could see any, if they could find anything, and I don't recall them ever finding anything in particular. I've never really, I could probably go back and look now in the day and age of computers the way they are now and the internet, I might be able to find something, but you know, when you ask him about it now, he looks at you like you're crazy. Well, I never said that, but he sure did.
But my understanding is that that's pretty typical, that the older they get, the less they remember. But
yeah, yeah. And then, you know, my granddaughter here, she is, I call her my little indigo girl. She's four. But when you talk to her, you feel like you're talking to a 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems to be very musically inclined. She likes to play keyboards, and she loves to sing. I mean, my...
What was that?
That was my phone beeping at me. I don't know why. Sorry.
Okay. I thought it was a bird.
No, okay. That's weird. But anyway, she's very talented. And my intelligence, trust me, I suck at math. Even though I'm in Mensa, I was 35 before I was able to balance my checkbook. All of mine is on the other side of my brain. I scored in the top 0.5% in the testing in the country in spatial relations. And I think that my son is the exception. He's like totally a computer genius. But my granddaughter, in particular, she seems to be more like me. Poor child.
Well, so maybe there is something, you know, to this, that the blood types and the intelligence and that sort of thing. It's really difficult to even, you know, to even talk to the average person, and I'm talking about the average person like I was 2.5 years ago about this, because, you know, most people would just blow you off and go, oh yeah, right, whatever, you know.
I'll believe. Yeah, I know. I always say, look, if I hadn't experienced this stuff or seen this things I've seen for myself, and I heard someone else saying this, I would surely think they were crazy. So, you know, they're entitled.
Well, we have a question from the chat room, and this comes from Kai Truth Seeker. And he says, please ask Deb and Tom if they have a lot of non-ET paranormal events like orbs or shadows, etc. Tom, let's start with...
Absolutely.
Okay, go ahead, Deb. Go ahead, Deb. It's all right.
No, I'm just saying, yeah, yeah, absolutely, yes. Oh, yeah. That's why I got into paranormal investigation.
Okay, so this is common for both of you, that you have paranormal experiences and not just ET experiences. And I'm hearing more and more from different people that I talk to and interview here on the show. That they feel that the ET spiritual paranormal world is all mixed up, that it's all part
definitely
of the
there's
same.
A connection. Let me tell you too, and I've taken to, I'm sort of like the EVP specialist for the INRIPA group that I work with, and I got 48 class A EVPs in one private residence, and for an investigator to do it for 30 years and get they'd be blessed to get that many in a career, and I got one, and I got it in one night. And the people that I work with now, they want me to go with them everywhere because it's like I'm some kind of antenna. So I don't know what that's all about.
I'd like to answer his question, too, if I may. Do I have
yeah.
a moment?
Yes, go ahead.
A lot of this, with respect to his question, when my son was born was when I had the most of it. That's when we went in, and my son was kind of turning from laying on his back. And at a month old, you can't turn over like that. And then he was down on his we went to get him in the morning. He was face down in his crib. And then another night, my wife thought there was something in the house. Well, I mentioned that it was like a vibe. It's like a three moon thing. Something's wrong, and you just get this. You got to check it out. And she went in to check on my son, and the rocking chair was near his crib and was just going back and forth. And there was also something with a drawer or something. I don't have that information in front of me, but that, to me, is the extent of it.
And then you've got, as far as that time of period, but when respect to the orbs and so on, I have seen those close up, and it's happened twice that has really been brilliant. And but it's always been before something else at a different magnitude would take place. So it's almost, as far as the orbs go, it's usually something that comes a day or two beforehand. But as far as the rocking chair and that sort of thing, I think that had to do with a visit to my son when he was very, very young.
You say the orbs usually come a day or two beforehand, what do you mean? Before what?
In 66, at the very first time anything had, when my brother and I were first abducted in 66, we had five orbs that appeared at the base of our bedroom. And it had, they kind of hovered at the top pane of the window, and then one of them kind of broke away and went about a foot below the ceiling and just kind of wrapped the room a little bit and kind of paused just before the door that led out to the hallway in our room, and which was pretty close to, you know, I could see it very clearly from my bed. And before that, my brother and I just, again, had this, it was a vibe that you get, that feeling that, you know, something's wrong, there's an energy, you know, there's anxiety. It's all kind of bottled up in one, almost to the point where your heart races a little bit because you're kind of scaring yourself for some reason. And it's kind of like, it scares you in the way that if you walk by a window at night and you saw somebody's face looking in the window, it startles you, and you, it doesn't mean you're in danger. It just,
that would scare me, yeah.
Right, it's scary. That's kind of how this is. It's kind of like, wow, it scares you, but you don't know what it is, and you don't know if you're in danger or not, but it's the not knowing that makes you kind of like, why is there an orb in my room? And the thing was, it was probably there longer than we thought, because where it was, I couldn't see the top pane from the bottom bunk the way that was. Oh, there was like this energy in the room. It was kind of lit up a little bit. And again, it's always that you can see more clearly a little bit. So we sat there and wondering why and talking to each other. And all of a sudden, I had leaned over to look at the clock. There was a white clock on my little nightstand. And then I just turned to the right, and that's when I saw him. And it was breaking away. And it was like, I described him as being like a hole in the air, but like with a, like a bluish ring around it, almost like a bubble. And I saw him later on. I saw him in 74. And that's where I got a better picture of it. And so I've got a really good idea of, it was about the size of a small coffee plate, you know, it goes under a mug of some sort.
Yeah, a saucer.
Yeah, a little saucer.
Coffee saucer.
Yeah.
All right.
Like,
go ahead.
Colors inside, you know, it's almost like something's inside of it kind of moves, and it's almost like you can put a tennis racket through it, but it looks solid, if that makes sense.
Deb, what's your experiences with orbs?
Oh, lady, that's a whole show.
God. Did any of what Tom said sound familiar?
Well, yeah, I can recall just not too terribly long ago. It's been a few years back. My stepdaughter came back home the first time. We were just standing in the, I can't remember, was it in the kitchen or the living room talking, and this blue ball of light, about the size of, I'm going to say, a marble, shot through the living room, down the, through the dining room, into the kitchen, and up the stairs, up the spiral staircase. And she looked at me, and she didn't grow up in this like my kids did in my family, you know. She looked at me, and she's like, what the hell was that? And I just kind of laughed. You know, you get used to this stuff. And when you live with this stuff as long as I have, it's almost like, well, when I was a kid, a lot of the strange little things that happened in our house, and, you know, I just assumed everyone had this because we did. I didn't know any different. It wasn't until I got in school and started talking about it and I started getting that reaction like, yeah, whatever, that, you know, I realized that this isn't like normal. One time I was sitting in the kitchen with my mom, or in the living room at my mother's house with my two boys, and I heard this pop sound, and I looked up, and as I looked up, I saw my mother put her head down, and the kids both were on the floor watching TV, and they buried their hands in their face in their hands, and this, oh, the whole room filled with this bright green flash of light, and there was this intense ball of green light about a foot and a half away from my mom's head in the middle of the living room, and I'm going to say maybe about 3 feet, 4 feet off the ground. When this light flashed in the living room like that, the light bulb next to my mother shattered. Then the lamp next to her, the TV turned off, and the telephone rang. All at the same instant. And yeah, tell me about it. I mean, you know, if this stuff were just happening to me, I think I've done slid down that slippery slope. But
let me interject something here. This is like crazy because you have never told me that before, and I don't think I've told you this. Not that long ago, in 2010, I was laying in my bedroom where my computer is, and I was, you know, kind of going back and forth with the keyboard and going talking a little bit on the phone. And just as I went to go to bed, I thought somebody was shining like a laser pointer, you know, like in my room, but it was green. You said green, right? This was like,
right, green.
I've got a picture of it. I took a picture of it with my phone, and I still have it. I thought it was somebody was playing, but there's no way that I'm on the third floor of my house. So, and I have these the shutters that are wood. They're built into your windows, and I pretty much close them at night. But I looked out at my window, and there's no way that light was. I have no idea where the light was coming from. And there was a tiny light. It was probably about the size of a, I'm going to say it was smaller than a dime. It was kind of small. But then it kind of got foggy-ish and kind of broke away, and it kind of looked like a worm, a greenish, like blurry little thing, of like a worm. It kind of spread apart, and then it went back to like this little, like it came out of focus. That's why I thought it was like a laser pencil or something. But anyway, I took my phone. I got like two or three pictures of it, and I'll send it to you, Deb, so you can take a look at it.
I've never mentioned that to you either. And then with the same little blue light, I was sitting in my car at like 3 a.m. at the corner of Washington Street and Cecil in Indianapolis, headed home from the night of being out with my girlfriend. And the same, and then this was years before. This was back in the, late 80s, early 90s. And that the same kind of blue light, same color and everything, about the same size, seemed to drop down out of the sky, right over my car. It swirled around my car, around the cab of my car where I sat. It flew around my car like twice and then shot back up off to the south, but up. And I'm like, okay, what was that? You know? So I don't know what it means. And like you said, I'm not afraid of it. It's not a fear like a terror. It's more shocking because it's like, it's as if someone had come up behind you and startled you. It's a startle because you don't expect it and you're not looking for it, but it doesn't really scare me. You know what I mean?
Well, is that because it's just kind of there and gone?
Probably, it's just so quick. It just hits you so quick. By the time you've caught up with yourself enough to be afraid, it's already gone, you know? And you're just left thinking, what the hell was that? And I sure hope somebody else saw that, you know?
I have the pictures of mine. I sent them to a buddy of mine in Honolulu, and I'm going to find the email, and I'll forward to you later, Deb, because I really want you to take a look at this, okay?
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Well, I want some, too. Send them to me.
I want to see.
Allison probably wants to see.
Absolutely. I'd love to take a look at that.
Okay, we're down to about 7 minutes or 8 minutes, I think. So I'd like to, Tom, I'd like for you to, if you would, share the testing you've had done. I know that you've had a lie detector, a polygraph test, and that you've also had some regression hypnosis.
Yeah, the regression hypnosis, and this is something I'm glad you brought that up. I really wanted to discuss that. The one thing that I want to say is that my family has had first, second, and third point of view on this. When I say that, I was actually in 67. I was abducted from my brother's and my bedroom with my brother on the top bunk, and I think we talked about that last time I was on. And at the same time that was happening, he saw me go. There were lights and all this kind of thing that, you know, everyone saw the lights. So it's not just like it just happens to one of us. And it's just like Debbie had the same thing. She's had, you know, first and second viewpoints. And it's to the point where, you know, I was on a craft, and my mother and my brother were doing something else, and there were, you know, beings in the house. And so, just to give you an idea, and there's times when my friends were there, and saw these things too. So, and the fact that I rode my horse up right off the bat, you know, right after it happened. I mean, the regression hypnosis came after the entire investigation. And this, again, this has been going on, 40 something years, and it wasn't until summer of 2010 when I agreed to meet with Mike and look into part of this. And it was 69, the situation in 69 with where the beings were completely different, that one it looked like a flying strip mall. That was if there was one abduction that really stands out as far as being different and cold and something you really don't want to remember, it was that one. And so after the investigation, and Steve did not want me to do it beforehand because it didn't want to cloud anything or tie in or taint the clear memories and the conscious memories, so we did it afterwards, and it added maybe, you know, 5 or 10% clarity to something, and things that you weren't really sure of. It kind of, you know, you go through it once or twice, and it's always exactly the same, and you know, so yes, it helped a little bit with respect to one particular part of it, but the investigation was already done when I did that, and so I think that's important, that not only were they clear memories, but you have multiple people at the same time that saw things at different parts of it throughout it. So
is your brother or your mom going to be regressed?
Well, Matthew is probably he's been talking to a friend of Debbie's, and he is probably going to look into one particular thing. He's probably going to look into he doesn't remember a lot of the situation with the SUV. He knows where he was coming from, his friend's house, and I don't want to get into it too much. He remembers bits and pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the physical evidence involved in it, you really got to look into it. So we're going to let him handle that with those that are working on the case. But he is going to cooperate as much as they need him to, and mm-hmm. follow whatever steps they want him to take to try to get to the bottom of it, or at least try to get in touch with what happened at a over time. I don't think he's going to jump right into it. The way he feels about it is this, that it's kind of like, you know, you open up a can of frozen vegetables or a bag of frozen vegetables in the freezer, and you reseal it and put it back in the freezer. Is it going to be locked as well as it was before you took it out? He's worried about the after effects of opening up, some streaming video, if you will. That's what he's worried about.
So he may have been, blocking these memories just to protect himself, and he's not sure if he wants to remember what happened. I could understand that, because it's kind of like once Pandora's out of the box, that's it. Okay, tell us about your polygraph.
You remember enough anyway without really having to do that. So is it really necessary to put them through it? That's where we are with it right now.
Right. Can you tell us about your polygraph now?
How the polygraph came about. Again, before the conference in Nashville, Steve had asked me, would I mind taking a polygraph with everything? And of course, I said from the very beginning, and I'll take them all day long. I don't care. But I only have taken one, and so I let Steve decide on the. And being an officer, he really knew this part of the. He knew where to go. He knew the good ones, and this was one that was connected with the municipalities and the police departments. They did a lot of testing for the police officers or what have you. So it was a solid facility and new equipment the whole bit. And so what happened before the national conference, I had to put together a summary of all my events and everything that took place from A to B. And so I did that. I started with what I was told in discussions with my mother in 54, went through 66, 67, 69, a couple of little things in 74, nothing my little orb deal. And then with my son, we talked about my son and the things that happened with him, and then took it from Matthew's case, what I knew about that, to February 2nd, and then just filled it in as much as I could with all the little different things I remembered. And Steve met me down there at where I was to take the test, and met in the lobby, and we talked about it with Steve and went over the events and everything, and he had his notes from when he was doing the investigation, and we just check and balance, dotted the T's, dotted across the T's, and just made sure there was a check and balance and everything was accurate. And we went in to see Jim, who performed the polygraph, and I sat there for 3 hours and just discussed the entire ordeal. And after 3 hours, I had no idea what he was going to ask me, and sat down and basically just asked me, did you lie about anything you just told me over the past 3 hours? And kind of blanketed everything, so there was no way out if I had. And I sat there, and he performed the test four or six times that day. And again, I basically...
How many times?
He went through each question at least four times, four different
okay.
times.
All right. And so you passed?
Yeah, well, 99%.
99%. All right.
99.1 to be exact.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So I think this case is really interesting. Now, I want to just be sure that the listeners are clear that the reason Tom and Matt have not come forward before this time is because their father or stepfather, they considered him father, was involved in politics in Connecticut. He was the mayor at one time and even has a memorial there to him. And as is many times the case, if you're a politician or you let this come into your workplace or whatever your career field is, sometimes you find yourself without work. So he was afraid that it would have an effect on his political career. So the family just didn't talk about this. Now, if I said that wrong, Tom, just jump in there. But
No, you're right. It was more like out of respect for him. I mean, if we were going to talk about it, it would have certainly upset him because he didn't want us to, but we just wouldn't even consider it. I mean, it's just not something you throw out there,
And their father passed away 4 years ago, and the family's talked about it, and they're ready to come forward. And real quickly, I think we've just got a couple of minutes left. I think I'm over time. I'm Joe Montaldo's sending me little messages here. So, Deb, tell people about the TV show you're going to do.
I'm not quite sure I know what you're talking about.
Well, aren't you going to do some kind of a paranormal show?
There was some talk about that, earlier on, that right now we've got an independent film crew that's following us around, and he's doing a documentary about paranormal investigators, what it's like behind the scenes, not like the stuff you see on Ghost Hunters.
Okay.
So it's more of a documentary than a television show at this point. So.
Okay. Well, we'll see what comes of that then. And Deb, give people the information on how to find you.
You can contact me through Ann Ripa's website at www.annripa.net, and my email address there is deb@annripa.net. That's MRIPA. I'm on Facebook. Hit me up.
On
and
Facebook,
I have a website of my own. Huh?
Yeah, on Facebook. We're all on Facebook.
The whole world is. I've got a website of my own. It's xgenco.com/Deb's Home. And I got a lot of cool links up there to a lot of interesting information. My husband is my webmaster. He keeps it pretty updated. I do an audio blog, so, yeah.
And, Tom, give them your website once again.
It's a lot easier than yours, Deb. It's tomreed.info.
Tomreed.info. Okay. Allison.
Do I have time for one question to ask Allison before we get off, or are we out of time?
Okay, go ahead.
Allison.
Yes.
With respect to how this case is classified, where is it in the, how far up the ladder or down the ladder is it as far as in the way that it's, I still don't quite understand.
Well, it's a really, really compelling case in my opinion. I don't.
As far as the way Steve's got it rated.
Well, I think that Steve absolutely closed the case out correctly. All we can really do is close it out as an unknown, which is absolutely what he did. And
I meant it's got a CE4, a 3, and I don't totally know.
Well, CE4 is Close Encounter of the Fourth Kind, which means that there was an abduction involved. So certainly that speaks to the nature of the case, and I think Steve handled it absolutely right.
And what's the 3?
Well, category 3 is for cases where, you've got actual, contact going on. So, that's
thing.
Yeah, it's pretty heavy stuff, So, I personally, in my personal opinion, I think Steve closed the case out beautifully, okay. And if I were the one working the case, I would have done the same thing.
Yeah,
it seems like there might be a gray, fuzzy line there if 3 is contact and 4 is also contact, but I don't know.
Exactly. Why I didn't understand a part of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Listen, we are way over time now, so I want to thank all of you, Tom, Deb, and Allison. I appreciate you all coming on, and one more thing, real quickly. Tell them, Tom, where you're going to be speaking at with Travis Walton.
Oh, well, we'll be at the, on the 30th of October, there is a paranormal and celebrity conference in the Marriott Convention Center, Kingsport, Tennessee. And I know Travis will be coming in. I don't know what time he'll be speaking, but I believe my time is between 4 and 6 on the 30th. And as far as how to reach that, I don't really know, but it is at the Kingsport Convention Center, Marriott, and I think it's under, it's like a Halloween combination type of thing, but actually, Allison, you know what it is, right?
Kingsport?
No, the name of the show we're going to, because you arranged it, I believe.
It's the Haunted Horrors Conference, and it is in Kingsport, Tennessee.
Okay, so you'll be speaking there with Travis Walton. I understand you guys have struck up a friendship. Seems like all of us involved in this, that's the one thing that I really like about this field is there, very nice people that take you under your wing and support you and give you a lot of love. And with that, I really love all of you guys. It's been a great show. Thank you so much. Thank you to the listeners, the people in the Pal Talk room. This is Angela Joyner signing off. Bye.
Took some midnight trains of many years.